Worth Repeating is made possible thanks to the support from the 80/20 Foundation, the Lifschutz Foundation, and Pasha Mediterranean Grill.
Some of the stories may not be suitable for all ages. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to the Worth Repeating podcast. I'm Tori Poole. This is the first part of the live storytelling event recorded at the Edma and Emilio Nicolas Media Center at Texas Public Radio in downtown San Antonio. The theme was found. From lost items to the things that come back, these stories are all about what returns. Can you think of something that you found? Our first storyteller is Paula Evans. Paula shares a story about a part of her mother's life she never knew existed. I know it's hard to think of our mothers of having lives before us, but we're glad that Paula uncovered more about hers.
When I was about 25, I woke up one morning and thought, I'm going to be a good daughter. My father had a heart attack a few months earlier, so I called my mother. Mother, how about if I come over 8 a.m. Saturday morning? I'll shovel the snow for Dad. Gonna have a late night, huh? My mother was never a fan of my schedule. I could use some help too, Paula. So I showed up about 7:30 Saturday, and that driveway was pristine. My father, the peacemaker, had probably gotten it shoveled by 6 a.m. So I walk in. He's sitting quietly reading his book in a chair, smiles at me, points upstairs. Why don't you go help your mother? So I take the stairs two at a time, and there she is, doing her second favorite thing after keeping a precise schedule, cleaning. She's polishing that already gleaming table in the hall. I said, okay, Paula, today we're cleaning all the drawers in the house, and you get to start with an easy one, my dresser. Oh, I didn't want to mess that up. My mother's room was forbidden territory. She'd say to us, this is the only room in the house where I have nice furniture without teeth marks or scuffs from toys. So I sidestepped in before she changed her mind, tiptoed on the carpet with its smooth nap. That bed had a smooth spread, the little chair at the correct angle. And there was what I'd always wanted to explore, mother's dressers. Because somewhere were mother's pearls, and I always wanted to try those on. So I start with the bottom drawer, the sweaters are all folded the same. Then Dad's drawers, his boxer shorts ironed and starched, the elastic to the left. No pearls. Next, her slips and camisoles. They could have been on sale at Macy's. They were so flat and perfect. No pearls. Finally, the last drawer. I open it slowly, and there it is. That satin box, Mother's Pearls. I close my eyes and open it. They're there. I'm going to look so good. But wait, there's a little white box in there. Maybe that's better jewelry. So I pick it up, and a little piece of paper fell off the bottom. I put that back. I'd already found the pearls. This little piece of old newsprint opened up. It's hard and yellow with age. I read the top, Washington National Examiner, May 1953. The column is The Inquiring Camera Girl, Jacqueline Bouvier. Jacqueline Bouvier? This reporter soon to become Mrs. John Fitzgerald Kennedy, America's first lady, with her tidy suits and her own pearls. So I'm reading this, and there's a stranger picture. Soft, happy face, no worries, twinkling eyes, soft hair in the breeze. And the inquiring camera girl asks, do wolf whistles bother you? This stranger says, why no? I turn and smile and blow a kiss or two, wouldn't you? have to know who this funny character is. And I look at the bottom and I read, Betty Hollis? Clerk typist, Department of Navy? My mother. Mother! Paula, what did you break? Nothing. I showed her the paper. Is this you? Paula, where'd you get that? Throw it away. That's another life. Is it you? Yes. Mother, I never knew you worked in Washington, D.C. Paula, there's probably a lot you didn't know about me. Did you know I went to the university? But I flunked after a semester. And after taking care of my brothers and sisters and mother and daddy, I couldn't go back yet. I got on the bus, went to D.C., took the clerk typist exam, got a room in a boarding house, and I still couldn't make ends meet, so I got a job teaching dance at the Arthur Murray part-time. Wait, you were a dance hall girl? Paula, I was a trained dance instructor. And yes, I met Jackie Kennedy and Eddie Fisher, too. Now, I had to sort out who's Eddie Fisher. I knew him as father of Carrie Fisher, Princess Leia, in about 6 Star Wars movies. I taught Eddie Fisher the foxtrot. At this point, her eyes are twinkling and her face is softening. I said, Mother, teach me the foxtrot. And she did. She took me in her arms. She led. She spun me. Swung me out. Pulled me back. Every step, I think the hair started loosening. The eyes twinkling, the face softening more and more. There was a smile. And I said, Mother, why did you leave that life? She said, well, Paula, Daddy had another crisis, and I had responsibility. I closed the door on that life. I'd had my year. I went back, got my old job at the Piggly Wiggly. One day your father came through my line, and the rest is history. First there's you, then Krista and Jonathan too. Paula, please. Throw that paper away. That's another life. So I did what she asked. I didn't want to, but I threw the paper away. Because that day I found someone. Not a mother. Not a daughter. I found a dancer.
This podcast is proudly supported by the 80/20 Foundation, dedicated to creating opportunities through education, community outreach, and meaningful impact. For this and more information, visit 8020foundation.com.
Our next storyteller is Shannon Irby. Shannon shares a story about finding herself drawn to a home she didn't think she could claim.
There is one question that is so difficult for me to answer, and that is, where are you from? You see, I am a military brat, a third culture kid, and we don't exactly have hometowns. My parents joined the Air Force, determined to see the world and to have exciting careers. And while they were living in Germany, I came into this world. From the age of 4, or at the age of 4, we moved from Arizona, from Germany to Arizona. And at 6.5, we moved from Arizona to Japan. Just before my 10th birthday, we moved to Turkey. Between 7th and 8th grade, we moved to D.C. And then between 10th and 11th grade, we moved here to San Antonio. I would go to live here in San Antonio for 6 years straight, the longest I had ever lived in one place at that time. My brother, who is 11 years older than me, can confidently answer that question because he spent a chunk of his childhood with his mom up the road in Houston. But me, I wouldn't know where to begin to answer that question. About 3 years after graduating from UTSA, I was in Korea living and working as an English teacher. And during one winter break, I seemed to be the only teacher in the city without any winter plans. And I'm not exactly spontaneous, but I asked myself, what is stopping you from taking a quick trip to another country? So I looked at the travel sites and searched for some clues, and I spotted one. Okinawa, Japan. Now, Okinawa holds a treasure trove of memories for me. But when I aged out of the military community, I had this belief that you could never really return to a place that you had lived before and left. Just like my childhood friendships, it was great in the moment, but once it was time to say goodbye, it was goodbye forever, and there was no expectation to see each other again. Still, I bought the plane tickets, and I got on a train a couple days later, and then I got on a plane, and I headed for one of my old hometowns. Now, Okinawa is this island south of Japan's mainland with its own culture and language and amazingly friendly people. It used to be its own kingdom. And it is a place today of fireworks and festivals, of these ginormous fruit bats that fly clumsily from tree to tree. It is a place where they have these annoying geckos that would crawl into my bedroom just before bedtime, claw up to the ceiling, lose suction, and fall on me. It is a place where my dad, having recently retired, decided to spend his free time with me and my friends, going for Pizza Fridays and to all the different parks and beaches dotted along the island. There were bad days, of course, but the good days far outshine them. So in contrast, well, the only memory I have of my own of Germany is the taste of strawberry ice cream, which is different, trust me. And in Arizona, I was really focused on getting used to American food and struggling to adapt to a questionable babysitter. In Turkey is a place I would have loved to love if it hadn't been overshadowed by my parents' divorce, a couple of traumatic birthdays, and starting seventh grade in a high school. DC was chaotic and loud and pushed me to the limits of my survival mode. Not only was I learning how to be an American again in this country, but I got a crash course in being Black in this country. And San Antonio has never really felt like home, but it has come to be a bit of a comfort zone and a safe space for when I go out into the world and need a place to reset. So, back on that plane, I was thinking all these thoughts, and I was feeling so overwhelmed that I started crying uncontrollably. And then I panicked because I was crying in public. And up ahead, there was a woman trying and failing to console her baby who had started crying the minute the plane started descending. At some point, the baby stopped crying, and so I looked up from my own mess to see what was going on, and that baby was staring right at me. And embarrassment and stares from one-year-old children will stop crying. So we got off the plane, and I let everyone go ahead of me, and I started crying again, but I took the time to console myself and tell myself, let's go out there with zero expectations and just meet a new world, a new reunion of sorts. And I went through immigration and I walked out those airport doors and the warm ocean breeze greeted me and the hibiscus and the palm trees and the sound of Japanese just calmed my soul. And I had a great time. And on my flight back to Korea, I had to seriously reevaluate my beliefs. That was back in 2014. And actually in 2018, I decided to move to Okinawa and I stayed there for about 5 years. And during that time, I came to realize that sometimes you choose you. Thank you.
This episode is proudly supported by the Lifshutz Foundation, a San Antonio-based charitable foundation committed to strengthening communities through philanthropy and support for meaningful causes. For this and more information, visit directory.tpr.org.
Our next storyteller is Ryan Aguirre. Ryan shares a story about finding order in a situation where others might catch fire.
When the fire started around noon on June 30th, 2024, I was in my office working on the thing that I most despised about my job, end-of-month inventory. I was the food and beverage manager at the second largest hotel in the state of Alaska, managing 7 outlets and a team of around 200 people, and I was on the fast track to my latest round of hospitality-induced burnout. As I looked across the river into Denali National Park, watching flames jump from spruce tree to spruce tree, I knew that the fire had other plans for that day, and my 5 p.m. deadline was not realistic. I called my partner, who was in our cabin at the resort, and I said, "Don't panic." Which, pro tip, if you ever want someone to not panic, don't lead with "don't panic." I said, "There's a fire across the river. Get our passports, pack a bag for us, a bag for the dog, and let's get ready to go in case shit hits the fan and we need to leave quickly." My next call was to my assistant manager, and together we devised a plan to communicate to our team that we needed to really start getting prepared for an imminent power outage, because I could tell based on my perspective and the aspect of where the fire had started that it was burning dangerously close to both the Alaska Railroad tracks and, of course, the power lines. The good news was we had experienced a power outage about a week prior, and so our team was recently primed and trained and prepped on how to respond to a power outage. And we also had the advantage of time on our side, because typically when the power goes out, you're reacting instead of preparing. So over the course of the next 4 hours, the fire continued to grow and grow to about 400 acres in size. Our team sprung into action doing all of the things that they recently experienced and learned how to do. And we started to wonder whether anyone knew there was a fire happening, because there was no response and no indication that anyone even knew that this fire had started. Around 5 p.m., we saw people jumping from airplanes with parachutes, smoke jumpers, the most badass of firefighters in the wildland firefighting system. They literally jump into chaos, wearing nothing but a parachute, carrying possibly an axe or a chainsaw. And no sooner did they arrive on the scene did we start to hear the sound of chainsaws cutting through black spruce as the firefighters worked diligently to establish a perimeter on the southern end of the fire, to push it to the north and to keep it from jumping the river and burning our resort to the ground. It was a Sunday, and just like every other Sunday, we were anticipating about 1,000 guests to arrive on our property, fresh off a cruise ship, hungry, tired, and probably grumpy. And around 5:10, 10 minutes after the firefighters started fighting the fire, the power finally went out. 30 minutes later, 1,000 hungry, grumpy, and some compassionate guests descended on the property. And we just knew we had to feed them and care for them and provide the most inspired version of hospitality that we can muster while we were currently panicking internally ourselves. And almost simultaneously at the moment that everyone started to arrive at the resort, so too did helicopters with large buckets dumping water onto the active flames, flame retardant airplanes dumping tons of flame retardant chemicals around the perimeter of the fire, and those airplanes that scoop water from large bodies of water and dump it strategically into the most intense heat of the fire. The chaos outside felt like it was mirroring the chaos inside the restaurants as we did our best to feed people with the most inspired and dignified options that we could produce given the circumstances. We made it through dinner service. Not everybody was happy, but the bars were open and that helped. And I started to think about the next day. I knew that in the morning, 200 people would be leaving our property to go to Fairbanks, their next destination on their adventure. And 800 people would be going into the national park to experience the full day Denali National Park tour. That's about an 8-hour bus tour that starts early in the morning. And so I knew if we could just get some coffee and get some grab and go options ready for people to just get them satiated and on their way to the park, the firefighters would have 8 hours to fight this fire, hopefully put it out or get it contained to the point that we could just go back to business as normal. Well, at 5 a.m., we heard from the National Park Service that they were suspending operations and all park tours would be canceled, which meant that the 800 people that we expected to just fill with coffee and, you know, put on a bus were now ours to care for the entire day. And to be blunt, we were not ready. But my team was amazing. They got ready as quickly as they could and again provided the most inspired, dignified hospitality that they could, despite the fact that they were still panicking themselves. Throughout the course of the day, a very strange phenomenon started to occur as 800 people were trapped in this property with no power and no running water. The firefighting efforts began to be perceived by these guests as a sporting event or a spectacle. And as I started to walk around the property and people start, you know, were crushing Coronas and Chardonnay and cocktails, throwing their fists in the air and cheering every strategic water drop by these professional firefighters as if their home team had just scored a goal against their arch nemesis. I had an out-of-body experience and just asked myself, what the hell am I doing? This is insane. But as the revelry was unfolding, so too was something else happening simultaneously without any power and water. We learned that day that there are two types of people in the world. The types of people, when told not to shit in a toilet, won't, and those that will. And unfortunately, on this day, the latter were in the majority, and we were on the fast track to a sanitation nightmare. So the decision was made that evening to move everyone off property the next day. They would be given 2 hours to pack their bags and on to their next destination, and their experience in Denali was over. And after everyone left around lunchtime that day, I started making the rounds, securing all of the outlets, locking doors, making sure nobody was in those spaces. When I got to the last of my seventh food and beverage outlets, the largest restaurant at the second largest hotel in Alaska, I locked all the doors and sat alone all by myself in this space where 300 people should be enjoying each other's company and celebrating the experience of being in one of the most beautiful places on earth. And as I locked the doors around me, I sat there by myself. The room was only illuminated by the glow of the Alaskan midnight sun. And I was sad. I was sad for all of our guests that didn't get to experience the place that they had spent months, if not years, and thousands of dollars preparing their entire lives in some cases to come and visit, and they never even got to cross the boundary into the national park. I was sad for my team, all of my employees that had arranged their lives around the summer of coming to work in this beautiful place to make connections and money and friends and just have the experience of being in this place that I'd spent 10 summers loving. And I was sad for myself because this feeling was strangely too familiar, and it transported me back to 2020 when I was managing a restaurant in downtown Seattle, and we were told that we would be suspending operations in this particular instance due to pandemic and disease. And now it felt like the fragility of my livelihood was returning in this instance, now confronted and, you know, facilitated by a natural disaster. So I went home and I went to sleep for the first time in almost 48 hours. And over the course of the next 3 days, the firefighters made tremendous progress, eventually getting the fire to the point of about 30% containment. And we got word on the night of July 4th that the power company would start testing the power lines for viability because we learned the power was cut to prevent the growth of the fire. So we devised a plan to bring in as many housekeepers and laundry attendants and servers and line cooks and dishwashers. And overnight, they got the resort in almost ship shape. It was absolutely amazing. They pulled off a hospitality miracle in the midnight hours, and we were getting ready to go back to operations as quickly as possible. The next day, we found out that we would be receiving about 1,000 guests on Sunday, July 7th. I just want to restate this. We took this lodge from 100% occupancy down to zero, completely sanitized and re-prepared everything, made it as perfect as we could for the guests that would be arriving, completely oblivious to the fact that chaos was ensuing just a couple of days prior to their arrival. We were back and we were able to provide inspired hospitality for these people that had spent months and years and thousands of dollars of their money to come to this beautiful place. And on Sunday, July 7th, around noon, people started to pour back into the bars and into the restaurants and occupy the hotel rooms. My team was back. They were inspired and more motivated than ever and excited to have jobs again. And it just felt so great to be back to business as usual. I made my way back to my office to finish that inventory project that just a week prior I loathed and viewed with such disdain. And with a renewed perspective and a passion for hospitality burning in me like wildfire through black spruce, that project didn't seem so bad after all.
This episode is proudly sponsored by Pasha Mediterranean Grill, serving up fresh, authentic Mediterranean favorites made with quality ingredients, from flavorful gyros and kebabs to crisp salads and homemade hummus. For this and more information, visit gopasha.com.
Our next storyteller is Randall Kowalik. Randall shares a story about understanding his father's train of thought after his passing.
It's the evening of Monday, December 29th, 2014. My dad has been dead for 24 hours, and I have no idea where his last will and testament is. It is nowhere to be found. My mother, she can't help. She's an Alzheimer's patient living in Freedom House, the memory care center in Blue Skies, the retirement community just west of San Antonio. So I've got to figure this out myself. A little bit about my parents. They were Depression-era farm kids. My dad was born in 1931. My mother was born in late 1932. And they were farm kids, but they had a slightly different childhood. My paternal grandfather died in 1935, when my dad was just 4 years old. And the family lost the farm a few years later and had to move to San Antonio. My mother, on the other side of the San Antonio River, her parents lived into their 80s, raised eight kids. That farm is still in the family. My dad graduated from St. Michael's Academy in the early 1950s and then was in the Army for about 2 years and then came home to San Antonio and joined the San Antonio Fire Department and was a firefighter for 40 years. My mother played volleyball in high school, graduated from Carnes City High School in 1951, then came to San Antonio, attended Drom's Business College, where she learned all the skills to be a secretary or a file clerk, jobs she had for about 25, 30 years. She knew Greg's shorthand. You remember the squiggly little lines that they used back then? And she was an amazing baker. Some Christmas Eves in the 1970s, we had 12, 13 different kinds of cookies to choose from, and coffee cakes, too. She was an amazing baker. She was very meticulous and organized with her financial statements and her bank statements. She kept everything neat and clean. My dad, not so much. He had ADHD, like me. So his closet was just a cluster of boxes and disorganized chaos, that kind of thing. Of course, when my mother's Alzheimer's began to kick in 2012, she began to lose some of those skills. And it frustrated her because she would put something up, forget where she put it, and then blame my dad, get angry at my dad, accuse him of stealing it. And this tension just built and built and built. And my dad used to talk about how horrifying it was to ride somewhere with my mother in the minivan, because my dad would be driving and my mother would be yelling at him and just taking out all her anger. You always did this and you never did that. Slapping her hand on the dashboard. It was all my dad could do to keep his mind on his driving. It was under those circumstances that they made one final visit to their attorney in 2012 to make some changes to their end-of-life documents. And then about 3 weeks later, they went back to the attorney, finalized and signed everything, came home. And that's all I knew. That's all I had to go on. So here it is again, it's Monday night, and I have to dive into my dad's closet and start going through things. And I open the door and I go in, and it's one disorganized box after another. I mean, I might open a box and find a set of garage door instructions, a box of old coins, and some old family photos or Christmas cards. It was chaos. Although I did find one box that was my dad's old memories from his time in the army when he was stationed in Germany. Something that my dad had never shown me when he was alive. I don't know why. I found photos of my older cousins when they were very little kids in the early 1950s. Photos that he had taken, but I had never seen. But this is getting me nowhere. Midnight, 1 a.m., 2 a.m., I'm not finding what I need to find. I finally gave up and took a nap on the bed in the bedroom. I woke up about 9 o'clock, and instead of diving back into the closet, I laid back and I tried to think about my dad that day when they had gone to the attorney's office for one last time. And I thought about the conditions of that drive, thought about my mother, mad, slapping her hand on the dashboard. You did this, you never did that. Holy sh! And I got up out of bed and I started moving down the hallway using the Walter Brennan, limp and stagger. You remember Walter Brennan from Rio Bravo with Dean Martin and John Wayne? Okay, I'm going. I'm moving down the hallway. I grab my keys. I go out into the garage. I pull the garage door up. I get in the minivan. I pull the minivan out into the center of the driveway. And I get out and I go around to the passenger side. I open the doors and I'm feeling under this and feeling under that and lifting up this and lifting up that. I go around back. I lift up the hatch. I look under the piece of carpeting. There's the donut spare tire where it's supposed to be. Okay, but still not what I'm looking for. And I go around to the driver's side. I feel under the back seat. And then I put my hand underneath the driver's seat and my fingertips touch paper. And I pull out the original copies of my parents' final end-of-life documents. There's my dad's last will and testament, the original copy. And I realized in a moment of brilliance, my mother and dad getting into the minivan at the attorney's office, my mother throwing a fit, and my dad, here, Lorraine, you hold on to these are important, so we don't lose them, handed her the photocopies. When she wasn't looking, he slid the originals under the driver's seat. Now, that leaves one question. Why didn't my dad tell me any of this? Did he forget himself? I don't know. But on that night, and that morning, I connected with him somehow, and he gave me the answers that I needed. The last will and testament was found. And also that night, while searching, I found some artifacts from my dad's life that gave me a little more insight into the kind of man he was in his younger days.
That's it for the Worth Repeating podcast. Do us a favor and give us a like, subscribe, or review us wherever you stream podcasts. Stay tuned for part two of the live storytelling event, now streaming. Worth Repeating returns this fall. Have a theme suggestion? Want to join the storyboard? Or maybe you just want to give us our flowers? We'd love to hear from you. Shoot us an email at worthrepeating@tpr.org. Worth Repeating is made possible by the 8020 Foundation, Lifshutz Foundation, and Pasha Mediterranean Grill. Worth Repeating is a production of Texas Public Radio. I'm Tori Poole. Thanks for listening.